You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
Mr. Speaker, yesterday we saw the worst of humanity, but we will remember the best.
We'll assess the aftermath of yesterday's attack on the UK Parliament. How's it affected London and how will its effects be felt in the weeks to come? My guests, Daniela Pellett and Matthew Green, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest developments in Afghanistan, where the Taliban have recently made significant gains. Plus, as the EU prepares to celebrate its 60th anniversary, we'll be getting a health check of the Union. All that and more ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellett, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Matthew Green, journalist and author. Welcome both to the programme. Always good to have you with us. Let's begin the programme by looking at the past 24 hours here in London. Yesterday, Westminster was placed on high alert after a car drove through onlookers on one of London's main bridges next to the Houses of Parliament. Two civilians, a police officer and the attacker were killed in the incident. 29 others were injured, many seriously. The suspect's been named today as a 53-year-old Briton, Khalid Massoud. What do we know so far? Matthew, it's interesting. As often with cases like this, we've seen truck attacks in other countries. We've seen instances being labelled terrorism before the facts have been known. What did you make of that, the way that information was managed, the way that the media dealt with this? Were you surprised? Did it sort of conform with your expectations for this kind of sorry event?
Well, I think it very much fits the standard pattern, doesn't it? It did become clear quite quickly that this was obviously a deliberate, premeditated attack. But other than that, we know very little about the man who was responsible. The police have come out and said the hypothesis is that it is inspired by Islamist terrorism. But obviously, a lot more remains to be known. And I'm glad you noted that he's British rather than British born. We were having this discussion earlier because Theresa May came out, didn't he?
Well, it seemed an interesting,
very interesting phrase.
Distinction,
yeah,
to make.
I think a very unfortunate phrase for lots of reasons, because British born puts a certain distance, I think, between us and this and the suspect.
Well, and it seems to imply something else.
I used to work at Reuters, and we always used to describe Osama bin Laden as Saudi-born. But the reason was that Saudi had revoked his citizenship, so he couldn't be described as being Saudi. And everything I've read, the scant details I've read about the perpetrator of this attack, suggests that he was born in Kent, lived in the West Midlands, had a couple of previous minor convictions. A British guy, not British born.
You see, unusually for me, I read it in a much more charitable way.
They were saying, you're a very charitable individual.
That's right. Not usually. They were saying British born before he was identified, I think, to try and scotch these rumours that it was to do with immigration and lax controls and the refugees bombarding our country. I mean, that's how... But then again, that is a charitable reading.
Wouldn't
it
scotch it more effectively to say he was British?
Also true.
Well, on that point, and we've got a selection of the newspapers from here in the UK, well, here in Britain, a few London papers as well, and how they covered it. A couple of things that struck me as interesting, and it's interesting you made that point about British-born, Matthew. It was on the Times, in fact, which we have in front of us here. They had an extraordinary full-page image, which was of the assailant, as we understand it, and the police officer who died, both receiving treatment at the same time, the headline assault on Westminster. And Daniela, this struck me as interesting as well. In their little sort of stand first, the Times of London in their paper this morning went with Islamist mows down pedestrians and kills policemen. Now, that rang slightly strangely with me. Does that strike you as a perfectly acceptable thing to say? I thought that was a funny choice of word, Islamist.
Well, I mean, if you look at the statement from the head of counterterrorism at the Met this morning, he released before 8 o'clock in the morning, there was no mention of Islamist terror. He said international terror. Okay, it's a code word. We know what it means. But I think the Times potentially trying to avoid these accusations that the media is too frightened to name it what it is. And having this argument with people online, rather foolishly, but that's the principle of journalism. You don't say what it is until you know what it is. I mean, it was very embarrassing yesterday. I think it was Channel 4 identified the terrorist, but wrongly, because the guy they identified was still in prison. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just an enormous danger in these kinds of things. I don't think it's important that we need to say the guy was a Muslim. I don't think that's the most important aspect of reporting it.
On that, well, on a sort of tangential point to that, Matthew, does the media sometimes, and we've talked about this before, tie itself up in knots somewhat by trying to get to the truth of a story, the heart of a story? When something like this is breaking, the news tends to come out in drips and drabs, often over a number of days, let alone hours. There's an understandable, I guess, obsession for the media. One thing that struck me, and I don't know whether you'd agree with this, as being particularly worrying, was even some quite well-regarded journalists, some, you know, senior BBC reporters, who would say things like, I haven't been able to corroborate this yet, but, and then went on to articulate said uncorroborated story. That didn't happen in the good old days.
I'm not so sure. You've obviously not read Scoop by Evelyn Waugh, because he painted that picture pretty accurately a very long time ago. Yeah, I mean, of course, we now live in this age of instant social media. Correspondents get up live and are under pressure to say something, and pretty much anything can come out of your mouth in that kind of context, which doesn't make it right, does it? But it is interesting, isn't it, to watch the kind of wave that comes after all of these attacks kind of crest and break. And obviously, there are people out there who seize on them to make political points. But at the end of the day, this is likely to be a pretty sad individual whose life has gone pretty far off the rails to end up at the age of, 53, ramming a car into pedestrians in Westminster. In a way, do we need to make too much of it? There's always been a fringe of people who've been drawn to violent extremism throughout the decades. It's
or even just to violent behaviour.
In a way, you know, we've had a lot of great stories talking about how London hasn't overreacted, which is great. But do we even need all those stories about how we don't overreact? I think we should move on.
Well, Daniela, on that point exactly then, it was funny today speaking with some colleagues, and quite sweetly, I suppose, some of our international colleagues had sort of checked in and said, is everything okay? But there was very much a sense of London at its normal work today. And actually, there was a certain banality, not just to that feeling, but also to this attack, as was it. It's far from high sophistication. It's no 9/11. It's a guy in a Jeep running over some people and then trying to stab somebody with a knife. It could not be more low tech.
Yeah.
Matthew's right, isn't it? Perhaps the way to move forward is to move on.
Well, it's very hard to get the balance right. I mean, I remember the events of 7/7 very well. And that was an enormous shock, not just because the scale of the attack was much larger, but because the assailants were British and British-born. We were all in shock. There was a very different atmosphere, although I remember going down to the area of the attacks, and people were going to pubs and, you know, carrying on, which we're quite good at. But yes, you're right, there's an absolute feeling of sort of banal ordinariness today, but I think that's also partly because terror attacks in European cities have now developed with this inevitable sequence of events. You have a hashtag, you have a Facebook add-on to mark people safe, you have ISIS claiming responsibility, whether they have anything to do with it or not. Then the media goes through, ticks all the boxes about the have-a-go heroes and the human stories as well. Look, this is significant. We can't be so inured to this, that the idea that the guy drives a vehicle along a busy pavement in the centre of London and kills lots of people and injures people. We can't just say, okay, well, let's not talk about it. It is important. But I think the reaction has probably been proportionate. Again, being charitable, I don't know what's come over me today, but I think in general, the media has also reacted quite responsibly and quite calmly. The occasional Daily Mail troll, obviously, has gone a bit radio rental about this. But in general, I mean, even the Sun front page said, I think it was maniac strikes at heart of Britain.
It was sort of measured hysteria.
It was measured. It was measured hysteria. There was no mention.
By
the Sun standards, yeah. There was no measure of mention of Islamism or terror or anything. No. He was saying, right, this is symbolic.
And the security services and the police had requested, for example, additional information about the assailant's identity not to be released at that stage, and most media seemed to go along with that for the most part. I just wonder, actually, Matthew, though, if we do compare this on an international basis, you know, you've worked in, well, parts of the world where attacks are far more grave than this in terms, yes, of the numbers, the impact, they're far more frequent as well.
Yeah.
And actually, this idea that, oh, good old British stoicism, we're just getting on with things, you find this everywhere. People are back in the markets of these cities that are struck.
Well exactly.
Whether,
yes,
it's in,
yes,
Afghanistan, in Pakistan, yes, or, I mean, do you think it's instructive to look at the differences in terms of how societies respond?
Yeah, I think obviously there's a great danger of sounding blasé about what was obviously a horrific event for the people involved, and could have been a hell of a lot worse. Mm. You know, thank God there weren't teams of jihadis with backpacks and clips of AK-47 ammunition wandering around different sectors of London for half a day. That's a scenario one can envisage, and thankfully it didn't come to pass. At least it didn't come to pass yesterday. But yeah, of course, you, living in Pakistan, Afghanistan, you have truck bombs detonating in marketplaces, killing 100 people in the blink of an eye, and life does go on. And I think it does go back to what we were talking about a moment ago. In this hyper-connected world, we have to be very careful to keep a sense of proportionality. When one looks at the past decade, the billions and billions of dollars, the huge loss of life that has been entailed through all of the policy responses from the US and its allies post-2001 is wildly disproportionate to the original, albeit extremely grave, event that happened that day. And the danger is that we normalize that. We've built this enormous security state. We've had these catastrophic foreign interventions. We've accumulated enormous debts, all as a result of tiny numbers of marginalized people managing to provoke that overreaction. And thankfully, this time, the mood is pretty measured. Mm. But let's keep it that way.
It's interesting the point you make about normalizing terror. I think a pertinent example is that of Israel during the Second Intifada, where I spent a lot of time. And there were lots of very dramatic suicide bombings and bus bombings. The Israelis made it a point of principle that the scene would be evacuated, cleared out, and life would carry on as normal incredibly quickly. I mean, you could pass the scene of a bus bombing in which 20 people had been killed. A few hours later, everything would be back to normal. But at the same time, the idea that the terrorists won't win and we will carry on and we won't be affected by them wasn't quite true, because similarly, the effect on Israeli society and perceptions of security importance and legislation and closing ranks and unwillingness to look at alternatives, for instance, to military solutions, that grew, that changed. It's a much less, the effect of the Second Intifada is definitely felt in ordinary Israeli circles today, in policy-making circles, and in the security system.
Well, I wanted to move on and look at how events we've seen could reshape political narratives, actually not just here in the UK, but more widely in the days, potentially weeks to come. But concerns rising in France, for example, that an attack of this sort could bolster the agenda of politicians like a Marine Le Pen in the French elections, which seem to be on something of a knife edge at the moment. There's obviously an anti-Brexit rally was long been planned for this weekend. That was in some doubt. It seems like it will probably go ahead. Matthew, what do you think about that? I mean, is it wrong-headed to sort of try and make a connection between an event like this and its aftermath with, for example, the French presidential election?
Well, I think it's very clear that these right-wing politicians are going to obviously jump on this incident to try to support the argument that we need closed borders to protect ourselves. It's obviously a fallacious argument. But we've seen Nigel Farage standing up saying exactly that. And unfortunately, there is a constituency of people who will be receptive to that argument. I don't know what the answer to that is, apart from challenge it with the facts, which is why, obviously, the identity of this attacker in this case was a very important aspect of the story.
Daniel, what do you make of that? I mean, clearly the likes of Marine Le Pen, Farage, these sorts of, I mean, let's call them what they are. They're opportunistic to a degree, which
they're
is understandable
demagogues, yes.
in politics. Is it acceptable for them to make political plays off the back of an incident like this?
Well, politics is a dirty business. Of course they would, and of course they will. But so far, anyway, I think domestically, we haven't seen too much of that opportunism. Theresa May gave a very measured speech in Parliament. Her response has been quite restrained. I mean, this is the woman who sent out vans to so people could shop illegal migrants. And as I said, the media has been quite restrained. The idea that you have some idiots like the EDL's Tommy Robinson, who legged it down to Parliament to announce that war was imminent, you know, that it shows how peripheral that kind of extremist view is. Mm. And for all, you know, Brexit, for all our polite xenophobia, I don't think British people have it in them to be that uncynical, and that's... I think we've got too much of a sense of the absurd to really buy into that kind of wildly violent rhetoric.
I think Nigel Farage, though, is a very dangerous demagogue figure who does pour poison into the body politic, because he is one of these politicians who is not interested in what the facts say. He's interested in a narrative of xenophobia and isolationism.
But even so, how many MPs is UKIP going to get? How many cabinet posts? How much actual political power?
That may be the case, but he delivered Brexit. You can't argue with that.
And I think I can argue that Nigel Farage single-handedly
helped to ferment a particular narrative and an attitude.
We know that Brexit, the decision about to take a referendum, was based in large part because of the threat posed by UKIP. So I'm not saying he delivered it single-handedly, but I'm saying that somebody who uses that that narrative. We saw the poster of the refugees breaking point. We hear the sort of statements he makes on LBC, on his radio station, the kind of tweets he sends.
But similarly,
I think he's a dangerous, insidious man.
I can't particularly disagree with you, but I don't think that translates into real political power. I think we still are too mainstream, and we've got too finely tuned sense of the absurd.
We've been hijacked into Brexit by a fringe element of the right wing of this country, who's now essentially taken the biggest decision since World War II, which would have been unthinkable 5-10 years
Matthew,
ago.
Hang on. Is that the full ins and outs of that story? It was a referendum. It went to the public.
A majority voted
for it. We know that there was a huge divide between town and country, older and younger. But, you know, you can't get fairer than a referendum, one could argue. I agree that on a knife edge it gets pushed one way or the other, but it's surely remiss to say it was down purely to this lunatic.
I'm not saying it was down purely to that, but I would argue that an idea that was very far from being anywhere near a possibility not very long ago has suddenly come to dominate the entire destiny of this country with incredible and alarming speed. That's why when I hear the likes of Farage and his allies, the Paul Dacres of this world, that the Murdoch press kind of whispering their poison, I feel tingles going down my spine.
Well, let's bring it back then to the events that we've seen transpire over the last 24 hours or so. And Daniela, you struck an optimistic note about a British public that's cynical enough to see through some of the most egregious rhetoric. Matthew, too, I mean, do you think is there enough of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a social conscience, an awareness about those fringe elements that you're describing, that, let's say, we're confronted by another event like this, maybe that's more grave, that has more casualties, that we can respond in?
I think my obvious personal animus for Nigel Farage aside, I think Daniel is right. I do think we have a very robust... We have a sense of ourselves as a nation as resilient, and as in some ways we'd be very reluctant to feel that we were being goaded or being kind of manipulated by what everyone can see is a fringe kind of lunatic elements. But yeah, vigilance is obviously required.
History bears this out, even going back as far as the Oswald Mosley. It was British people are very sceptical about groups of people with funny moustaches and silly uniforms. We really don't go for it. And since the 80s, you know, we've had all these scares that the BNP was going to be the new face. It was the new face of the NF, and they weren't skinheads. They were clever and they were Oxbridge educated, and they were going to have this many MPs. They fizzled out. Same thing with the English Defence League. Same thing with Britain First, etc., etc., etc. We should remain vigilant, absolutely. And there is a nasty streak of xenophobia in our society, which has only got worse since Brexit. But in terms of political power, there's nothing to compare to the situation elsewhere in Europe.
Daniela Pellett and Matthew Green, my guests today on Midori House. More from them as we discuss other topics, including this weekend, the EU is 60 years old. Is it starting to show its age?
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're listening to Midori House, still with me, Daniela Pellett and Matthew Green. Let's switch sites internationally somewhat. The Taliban has captured the district of Sangin in Helmand province today. To tell us about the significance of this, Matthew is here and he's reported extensively from Afghanistan. Matthew, tell us about this, because it's interesting to look at the recent history of Sangin, the battle for control, its symbolic importance, its strategic importance. What do you think that these developments, if they're borne out and if the situation sticks, tell us about where Afghanistan's going?
Well, Sangin is the district where Britain suffered its highest numbers of casualties during their part of the war in Afghanistan. And I'd argue that it has much more symbolic significance for that reason than it does really strategic significance. It's always been a big hub of the opium trade, which is partly why the Taliban have been so eager to recapture it, because that's their main source of revenue. But really, the bigger picture here is the West has more or less pulled out the vast majority of its combat troops over the past few years. We've handed the war over to the Afghans, and the Afghans can't cope. And the levels of casualties that they're suffering are astronomical. More than 5,000 killed in action in 2015. When you compare that to 452 British deaths in Afghanistan over 14 years. We don't know the figures for last year yet, but they're probably well in excess of 5,000, with tens of thousands wounded. I mean, that is an enormous rate of attrition that the Afghan security forces are suffering. And we very rarely hear anything about it. Whether or not they, the issue is not whether Kabul is about to be overrun tomorrow. That's not going to happen. But we've handed over this conflict that's likely to run and run and run and run.
And Daniela, that's true, isn't it? It's an astute reading, and the figures are damning and deeply concerning. And it doesn't seem to be any particular place to look to find reassurance to the contrary.
Well, am I supposed to be optimistic?
I'm coming to you for optimism again.
Well, you know, look, the Afghan army has done pretty well in a very bad circumstances. They did a good job of securing the presidential elections both rounds. That was quite an impressive success. But there's a limit to what they can do, and there's a limit to what can be achieved without a political solution, a political horizon. The Taliban don't need to take control of every provincial capital and every major city. What they need to do, and which is exactly what they are doing, is controlling the districts and the regions outside the provincial capitals, which means that the Kabul government has very, very little control. They can't deliver projects. They can't recruit people to, you know, infrastructure work. They simply can't govern. So as long as this situation goes on, it's a win-win for the Taliban. They don't have to do so much the job of government, but they can luxuriate in the fact that their control is very, very real. The idea of peace talks with the Taliban has been floated for a very, very long time, but it seems that it's going to be quite hard to negotiate from a position of power the longer this goes on. And indeed, you know, many, many problems have been raised, the idea of reaching a peace deal with the Taliban, not least the effect on human rights in general and women's rights in particular.
Let's come back to Europe. This weekend, the EU will celebrate its 60th birthday. On the 25th of March 1957, the Treaty of Rome was signed by France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Italy, the Netherlands and West Germany. Few, though, would argue that this weekend's anniversary arrives at a high point for European relations. Greece and Poland are threatening to object to signing a new declaration charting the future of the post-Brexit EU. And we have other issues. Turkey's deteriorating relationship with the Union hangs heavy. It's not all bad, though. A new survey in Germany reportedly reveals support for the Union in the country is at a 25-year high. We said a health check, Matthew, of the EU's status. What's the prognosis in your doctor's view?
Well, there's a few pitfalls ahead, aren't there? I mean, the list of problems that the EU's facing is pretty significant, from the obviously managing influx of refugees and migrants. You have the financial crisis in Greece and the potential implications for banks in Germany and elsewhere. Ongoing problems with the euro. And I think now it makes much more sense to think about the split in Europe between north and south, in as opposed to east and west, which is obviously the divide that the whole enterprise was seeking to overcome.
And what about that idea? I mean, some people are saying, look, it needs to be multi-track, multi-speed Europe. The problems with the currency and other things have arisen from trying to standardize, to make something that's heterogeneous, homogeneous. But is that practical, though, Daniel? Well, could you have such a multifaceted system running at different speeds?
I'm sure the Germans might be quite happy about that, but numerous other members of the European Union would be pretty cross, and they don't want that to be the case. Is it practical? I don't think so. But I think, very sadly, the prognosis is very, very poor for the EU. And what we've seen over this whole fuss over the 60th birthday celebration shows how much it's become a forum for people to play out their own domestic troubles. I think half the statements that are made between the Greeks and the Poles and so on, to a certain extent the Brits as well, it's just saying what's wrong, you know, with this is all about domestic problems. They're all trying to get domestic capital at home and making an argument. It's just become like a sort of a deeply dysfunctional family at the dinner table, really. And what everyone's arguing about is their own marital problems, not really the wider family issues.
But it's interesting, though, Matthew, because obviously it's had half a century where people managed to put those personal interests to one side, at least outwardly. Do you think one of the issues is that's because there was a lot of very fresh memories? You go back to the 50s of what had just happened, wars in Europe, wars on the mainland. Again, are people becoming a bit complacent? Have they forgotten to look at the lessons of history? Is that one of the problems? Or do you think that this broader problem about nationalism and self-interest is something that would have arisen anyway?
I think it would have done, but there's also the question of the euro, isn't there? And how feasible the idea of having a central bank regulating the currency with that, while at the same time having national governments setting their own budgets. Was that ever a stable basis for a currency union? And it looks like it might not have been. I mean, I hope that it will muddle through, but it's clearly not been the stable arrangement that the founders of the euro were hoping for. And that question has yet to be fully resolved.
In a word, then, should they cancel the cake for this weekend?
I think it might taste rather bitter.
There you go. We ended on a note of pessimism. Sorry, I tried to strike the opposite note. That's Daniela Peled and Matthew Green, my guests today on Midori House. Thanks to them. Thanks also to the show's producer, Tom Hall, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Naomi Joseph, and to our studio manager, Toby Hammond. We have more music coming your way next at 1900. Andrew Tuck will be with you, bringing you The Urbanist, and we'll have more on all the main stories of the day, with the latest, of course, from London, too, on the Monocle Daily. That's coming up at 2200 London time here on Monocle 24. We're back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye.